Stand by. Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
It's a real treat to welcome singer Bill Wadhams to the show. He's the lead singer of the 80s synth pop band Animotion, who took the world by storm with their hit songs Let Him Go, I Engineer, and of course, Obsession. Social media expert Patrick Charles drops in to talk about how one generation has completely changed the music industry landscape, and then we wrap things up with public speaking experts Katrin Kern and Chris Corbell giving us tips on how to create a top-notch wedding day toast for the happy couple.
Capture your need for sound.
We're very happy to welcome to the show lead singer of the 80s synth pop band Animotion, Bill Wadhams, who continues to thrill audiences today with their songs like Let Him Go, I Engineer, and of course, Obsession. Bill, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. Nice to be here with you.
So you have to start off by giving us a lowdown on how you and the other members of Animotion came together, because I think, you know, for people that want to remember what went on, how did it all start?
Well, it could be a very long story, but I'll try to condense it. Basically, Astrid, my co-lead singer, she was in another band called Red Zone, and we were both playing around Los Angeles. I had my own band. I think at the time it was the Billy Bond Band. That was my surname. And at a certain point, a manager who was managing Astrid in her band saw me. Her band was breaking up, so he called me and he said, "Hey, I've got this singer from the UK, and she's fantastic, and her band just split up, and they're looking for a guitarist, singer, songwriter in this band, and would you meet with them?" And so I did. I met them, and we hit it off. We started rehearsing together, and in kind of short order, an A&R guy from Polygram Records came to see us, and he thought that with the guy and the girl, we could be what he called a Fleetwood Mac of the 80s. And so he signed us on that premise.
And can you explain, you know, everyone wants to call you guys this, that, and something else, like synth pop, new wave. How would you have described your sound?
You know, synth pop, new wave, that's fine. When we first started out, we were essentially a rock and roll band. Guitar, bass, drums, keyboard. Most of my songs were sort of guitar-based. While we were in our recording process, when we started working on Obsession, it took a whole nother tone, and synthesizers became more important then. And so we became known more for that song. But if you listen to the first album, there's a lot of songs that were very guitar-based.
Okay. And, you know, the 80s were big, bad, and crazy, big hair, big money, big good times. When your music started to take off, were you guys like in a bubble? Was it like this roller coaster ride and you were just, you know, swept along with it?
Yeah. What happened was we actually recorded our album and Obsession was released. The video was done, but it wasn't until almost a year later that it started to really take off. And that's because one station in Los Angeles picked it up in kind of a battle of the bands situation, and Obsession beat out other bands five nights in a row, and people started calling into this station, and other stations around the country took note because it was such a prominent station in L.A., and so then it swept across the country and then around the world. At the time, you know, we were not very active. We were playing around Los Angeles. That was about it. When the record company saw that we were climbing the charts, they threw us in a Winnebago and booked a tour from San Diego to Vancouver, BC. And that was our first tour, a West Coast tour. And while we were on that tour, the song Obsession was jumping about 10 chart points in Billboard magazine every week. So it went 80 to 70 to 60 to 50. And by the time we were still on tour when it was in the teens with a bullet on its way to the top 10. So then that's when we really knew that we were about to take the ride.
And did you know, Bill, at the time that Obsession, like when you guys were recording it, did you have any clue that it was going to go? Because I'm always fascinated if you guys like ended up having like a gut feeling. Like I always like to ask singers that if they've had like such a huge track, if they knew somewhere that it was going to blow.
You know, Astrid did know. Astrid will say that she felt like this could be a huge hit. I personally, even when we were doing the video, I thought, well, this is a fun exercise. We're shooting a video in the Hollywood Hills with the Hollywood sign behind us in a house where Beverly Hills Cop was shot, this big, huge mansion. And it was all very surreal to me. But even then, I thought, you know, I don't see this being, you know, I don't see this catapulting us into stardom or into, you know, the popular culture. I didn't see it myself. I was the principal songwriter of the band, but I did not write Obsession. So when it started to climb the charts, I had mixed feelings because I didn't write it. And some of the reviews were saying, if you love Obsession, you may not like the songs that Bill wrote. So I was, at the same time, we were climbing the charts, but I was kind of finding myself in a precarious position as the writer and musical director of the band. And that turned out to be, you know, a really tough road for me, because even with my own record company and publishing company, I was always having to convince them that I was, you know, that they should listen to my songs and that they should have a priority when choosing what goes on the album.
And when you look back at those times, and then now that you guys are back together and doing your thing, are you, I don't even know what the word would be, are you happy, impressed, surprised that that song and the feelings and emotions that your fans had back then has carried on decades later?
Well, you know, looking back, like so much of life, it's really double-sided. You know, it's wonderful and kind of awful. There's a lot of wonderful things about it. I mean, I have so many friends in music back then and still today, and my son, Charlie Wadhams, charliewadhams.com, is in Los Angeles. He's had music and movies and TV, yet he's never had a hit song. I have huge respect for him as a songwriter, and he's done everything on his own terms. When we were coming up, we were so much directed by record company managers, and we were not very savvy in terms of guiding our own career. So there were a lot of wonderful times, but we sort of crashed and burned at a point because we were divided in what we thought we should do, and that weakened us in our position to the record company. And I wouldn't want this interview to sound like a sour grape deal, because it's not, because we really did have the time of our lives. And now, in the present day, we're still able to fly across the country or to another country and play a show with some of our peers, who we really enjoy. And, you know, people will come out and in a moment it feels like time, you know, we're right back in it, and we love that. You know, a lot of things have changed. So, yeah, we had a wonderful, wonderful time, although there was a lot of behind the music trouble.
Right. Actually, I wanted to ask you about that. When you guys did sort of part ways and stuff, did you ever think that you guys would return and be a group ever again? Because you have managed to do that, to make it happen again.
Yeah, no, I did not. I really did not think. I mean, I'll give you an example. Well, in 1986 or 87, I guess, was when the band really fractured. Management was suggesting very strongly that we replace Astrid, and we got caught in kind of a, you know, big power play, and I, along with the guitarist and the keyboard player, we sat down with Astrid and her boyfriend, the bass player Charles, and we said, the band is splitting up, we're taking the name. So it was a pretty hardcore move on our part, and they were extremely upset. About 10 years later, I sat down with Astrid and Charles and had a drink, and we laughed, we cried, we you know, we kind of came to terms. And this was about 2000. And we said, well, if there's ever an opportunity for us to do something, maybe, you know, maybe we will. But we didn't really make a plan then. And then about a year later or so, I got a call from someone who wanted me to appear at an event. And I said, well, you know, and they were going to pay me a certain amount of money. And I said, well, if you're going to pay me, why don't we see if we can fly Astrid up to share in this event? And I called her up, said, do you want to do this? And it turned out to be a full-fledged reunion, because once I said, well, okay, I can get Astrid, they said, can you get anybody else? And so I started calling the band members up, and they're like, yep, we'll do it. So we had a full-fledged reunion. And after that show, we sat around in a hotel. It was like the Little Rascals going, I can build a website. I can get a booking agent. I'll fly, you know. And we were back together. And at one point, we were on a few years later, we were on a jet flying home from a gig in Orlando, Florida. And Astrid said to me, you are the last person I would expect to be traveling with at this point in my life. It was a really sweet moment for us after so much, you know, some hard times between us. And now it's so sweet. She's really quite dear to me, and she gets along famously with my wife, Kate, which works really well for me, because I go out of town to meet another woman, and my wife's okay with that.
That's amazing. Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Bill Wadhams, co-lead singer of the popular 80s band Animotion. Make sure to check out their website, animotionlive.com, and Bill's own website as well, billwadhams.com. Bill, I wanted to ask you as well, what is it like when you look back on those times and when you were appearing, you know, sort of, you know, on stage or alongside on the same bill, if you will, with others, 80s acts like Depeche Mode or Simply Red, Phil Collins? Was there a camaraderie between all of you guys, or quite the rivalry?
You know, I never felt a rivalry. It's funny you should mention Simply Red. When we played at the Montreux Rock Festival, I think that was one of the most unusual situations, because Montreux, Switzerland is a small town, and it was filled with so many bands. It seemed like there were more bands and musicians there than you know, waiters and hotel staff. I mean, it's just amazing. And the venue had three stages, and I don't know if MTV was broadcasting it live, but it was one of the biggest world broadcasts of music at the time. And there were three stages, and then they would just go from one stage to the next stage to the next stage, and it would be Roger Daltrey, and then Eurythmics, and then Simply Red, and then Elvis Costello, and then Mike and the Mechanics, or Genesis. I think it was actually Genesis, which kind of blew me away, and Queen was there, actually. So that was mind-boggling, and I'll never forget being backstage, and Mick Hucknall was giving Billy Ocean a hard time, because we had a choice at that festival of either to lip sync or to sing live, and Billy Ocean had chosen to lip sync, and Mick was going to sing live, and so he was kind of ribbing him in a really, you know, funny but not, you know, not rude way, but they were having a whole time of it. And then I noticed that Annie Lennox was just kind of standing by herself over on the, you know, on the side, and I went and I approached her. And I had one of my most memorable conversations with this dear person, who is really my favorite encounter with anyone, was with Annie Lennox. I think anybody who knows her knows what a compassionate person she is, in a very global way. And that was one of my favorite meetings.
Bill, what would you say is your crowning glory with regards to all of you 80s acts, like, you know, from that era? Like, what do you want people to really remember about those times in the 80s? Because I almost feel like every decade has their thing, and you guys were such a powerful decade with all the acts that I've mentioned, and obviously other people as well. What do you want people to remember and know about those times?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, you know, what I'd like people to know is that Animotion, that there's more to Animotion than Obsession. And I don't know. It's that's the main thing, and that we're still here. You know, that we're actually still playing. And when we reunited, we were able to reunite with all of the original members. with the exception of our original drummer. And now, not all of the original members play at every show. But what happens is, if, for instance, our guitarist plays with Rod Stewart, he's been with Rod Stewart for about 12 years. He's currently playing with him. So if he's not with Rod, he'll come and play with us. If he is with Rod at the time, it's so much fun to call up other guitarists. Sometimes we've used a guy named Eddie Martinez, who was Robert Palmer's guitarist on Addicted to Love and Simply Irresistible. So many wonderful songs. He was also in Run DMC and King of Rock and everything. So he lives in Portland, Oregon, where I live, and he's just one of the most fantastic guitarists in the world. And so we get to play with him sometimes. So I guess, you know, a lot of people didn't see us as a live band. We didn't do as much touring as some other bands. Part of that was financial reasons. One of my biggest regrets is that I turned down a world tour with Depeche Mode in 1986, because when I looked at the numbers, I just realized we were going to go deeply in debt to the record company if we went on tour with them. And looking back, I wish that I had changed that decision, because it kind of, going in debt to the record company just means that they're not going to pay you anything. It doesn't mean that you actually have to make payments to them. But without getting too deep in it, on our first record, we paid back the record company almost $500,000 from what they had invested in us. And I looked at that and I was appalled. So I was really reluctant to go into their, you know, into have them advance us money for a tour with Depeche Mode and then find out that we didn't make any money. So there you go.
And Bill, before I let you go, what message do you want to give to your fans that, you know, are still ardent fans and enjoy seeing you guys and listening to your music?
Well, a lot of people ask us, when are we going to come out with new material? Are we going to come out with a new album? They're probably, a lot of them, tired of asking. We have recorded a number of songs. The hard part is finishing them and getting everybody to agree that this is the way it should sound and this is, you know, what we're doing. And there's also an expense involved, and we don't have backing. So I guess what I want to tell fans is that look at our website and please like us on Facebook. There's an Animotion Facebook page. I think there's two of them. One is put up by Wikipedia, which is not us. You find the Animotion page with a picture of the band, and like that. And we will be making songs available for free, some new material for free on Facebook and on our website.
Awesome. Bill, thank you so much. It's been so great to chat with you.
My pleasure, Kelly. Thanks for having me on.
That's Bill Wadhams again, co-lead singer of the popular 80s band Animotion. Make sure to check out their website, animotionlive.com, and of course, Bill's website as well, billwadhams.com.
This is Bill Wadhams of Animotion and Kelly Alexander. You are my obsession, baby.
We often talk about the death of the music business, but more than anything, it's a version of the music business that's actually gone. It's changed, and we know who changed it. To explain all of this, our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Patrick, thank you for being with us this week on the show.
Hello, how you doing?
Good. So I think this is obviously a really interesting topic. And, you know, for people who aren't maybe like, you know, as tuned into this, who is responsible for the mess that the music business is in?
Well, I'll tell you, it's, you know, millennials.
Okay.
People born 80s, 90s. It's amazing. They are the ones who, you know, because we talk about the fact that people don't buy CDs anymore. And it's easy to say, you know, like, oh, nobody's buying CDs. Nobody's buying CDs. But I wouldn't say nobody's buying CDs. I would say that younger people aren't buying CDs.
Yeah,
that has a lot to do with it.
And is that ever going to get better? Do you think we're going to have like a resurgence?
No, I don't think so. I think that everything will remain kind of niche as it does now. Like people have turntables, but it's not going to come back. Like a lot of people say, oh, vinyl's making a comeback. It's like, no, it's not. There'll always be 2% of the people who like vinyl, and it'll stay at 2%. It's not making a quote unquote comeback. It's just going to, you know, it'll always be around because people will always dig it. But it's like anything, you know. You know, like in the summertime, you see guys driving like cars from the 50s.
Right.
With the roof down and stuff
yes.
that they worked on all winter in their garage.
Yes.
Yeah, that's not making a comeback.
No.
There's just always going to be a few guys like that. And that's kind of, you know, what I equate CDs with.
Okay.
Same kind of thing. Hobbyists.
Actually, yeah, I can totally see. And I like that you use the word niche because I feel like that explains it. Is Napster, you know, who sort of kicked things off all those years ago, and file sharing part of being the big culprit in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it is because, I mean, that's where this whole thing kind of started. But what's interesting about it is like, it's the kids who sort of came into music at that point in time and how it's changed them. Because it's one thing to say, like, you know, this is the thing. Like, people love to say, okay, well, file sharing is what killed it. But what happened is it actually changed the culture more than anything. You know, there were a group of people who were file sharing in the late 90s, early 2000s, and still, of course. But what really changed is the fact that people who grew up after that, people who weren't born or people who were little kids at that time in the late 90s, they just never got into buying records or owning CDs.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if I can use myself as an example, it's kind of interesting how the last couple of years, apart from like the big artists that I enjoy, and even some of them, for example, like I haven't gone out and gotten a hard copy of Justin's 2020 experience. Whereas
right, right.
like in 06, I did. Like I did go get his Love, you know, Future Sex Love Sounds CD.
And now it seems less important, right?
Yeah, which is kind of weird because like that's not like I like, you know, and I would think of myself more than anyone, especially, and I would put you in that category and stuff because this is what we do for a living, that like it would be important to go get it. But for some reason, like, I don't know, and I love Justin, but I just had never, like, I have not gone and got a physical copy, even though I actually really still get a buzz when I open a copy of anything.
With a crowbar, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Those little CD sticker things, yeah.
Exactly.
For sure. But yeah, that's the thing. That's what I'm saying. Like, the culture's changed where people aren't really so hung up on ownership as they used to be. We used to be really into ownership, you know, used to say, like you said, when the big record was coming out that you wanted to get, the big thing was can't wait to go and get my copy.
Yes, exactly. And like read the liner notes and like see the artwork and like all that kind of stuff. And it's funny because I was recently going through my CD collection, actually trying to sort of find some things and like some of these CDs I hadn't seen in a while. And it's funny because when I did see them, when I did even just pull them open, like right away I was transported back to like whatever year, like 97,
absolutely.
98, like whatever, 93. And so it was such a good feeling to have those. But it's weird because like I feel like the kids these days aren't going to have that feeling of like, because it's like, I don't know, like I said, that CD, let's say the Janet CD from 93, like that's like nostalgia for me and it brings me right back. And it's like, but it's like a living, breathing thing, if you will, even though I know it's like a CD. But like the kids these days, they don't have knowing like, oh my God, this was the summer of 2014.
I tell you, these kids today.
These kids today.
It's,
I sound super
old. Yeah,
it's
amazing. I mean, but that's changed with everything though. I mean, you can look at it as far as like television goes, right? I mean, Orange is the New Black comes out and they just, you know, put the whole season up on Netflix right away.
Right.
So you can just watch them all. There's no more of that sort of anticipation. That's what I mean about the culture changing. Like we just don't do things the same way anymore.
Uh-huh.
Like there's no more sort of running home to watch your show Thursday night at 8 o'clock because you'll just, you know, either download it or, you know, watch it on, you know, watch clips on YouTube or, you know, watch it on your computer the next day, basically. So there's no sort of urgency to that anymore. And that's part of the ownership thing I'm talking about. It was like, you know, are you home at Thursday at 8 o'clock to watch whatever show? And that's kind of gone now.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny because that only actually recently left for me because I didn't have a PVR. Like, for the, I've only had a PVR for the last, I guess, well, probably, I guess I'm coming up on a year. It'll probably be a year in September. And it's completely changed me because, like, for example, I'm a Young and the Restless freak. And so it was either that I watched the show because I was, you know, working my lunch schedule around it, or I missed three episodes because, you know, I was at work or something.
Yep.
But now, like, I set it to record, like, every day Young and the Restless is getting recorded whether I'm there or not. And it's changed my viewing habits because now, like, I'm not bound to, like, eating lunch at 12:30 all the time.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's really changed things.
And do you think people will survive with these quote-unquote new rules?
Well, yeah, because what's happening is a lot of people are looking at the marketing, like, for, you know, brands, for, like, you know, things like Red Bull. They're using music to sort of identify themselves because they know that people identify themselves with music. So as far as tying music to products goes, that's where it's all coming from now.
Right.
You know, that's how everybody's surviving. It's pretty amazing actually because it's completely changed the way people interact with music and they've never done it more than right now.
And is it just the distribution of music that's changing or is it like, I don't even know, like just like a culture shift, if you will, right across the board?
Well, it really is because if you look at the way people discover tunes, it's a pretty amazing, there's a pretty amazing study on that. And the number one way that people 12 to 24 keep up to date with music, mm-hmm. what do you think it is?
YouTube?
Yes.
Really, eh?
That's the number one way. Yeah, that's, I mean, like a big chunk of people check out YouTube every day, like 83%. Of people 12 to 24.
And where
check
are they
out
going?
YouTube,
just like the main page and sort of seeing what's hot and what's posted? Like, is that?
Yeah, well, I guess it's a combination of that and stuff that they, you know, maybe subscribe to or you know, that they follow on a regular basis. But yeah, 83% of people in that age group, they just every day get onto YouTube, see what's happening.
Wow. You know, it was funny. I just had this conversation with a friend of mine earlier today about trying to stay on track of things actually. And we were actually talking about you. Cause I was like, I'm like, Patrick is so good about staying on top of everything. I said, I don't feel like there's enough hours in the day for me to sort of figure out where I need to be all the time. And I said,
aren't.
Exactly. And I recently just said to her, like today in the conversation, I said, I've now forced myself every week to go to billboard.com to make sure I know what's coming up. Cause I said, I'm so out of the loop with all the new stuff all the time that I'm forcing myself. Not that I should say forcing myself, but I'm making the time, making a point to know like what's coming in on the charts, like at least the dance charts, the EDM charts, and obviously the top 100 so that I know because it's so easy to be left behind even though I work at a radio station.
Yeah, it's so difficult. But I mean, that's the only way to do it, which is funny because you have to do it in a systematic sort of way. You can't just do it. You know, you can't just let it happen and let it come to you because you'll miss about 75% of everything. So you actually have to get on it and look at what people are sharing and what people are listening to and what's getting to the top of the charts. And when I say the charts, it's not one chart anymore.
Yeah.
It's about 100 charts.
Yes. Right? It's so, and it's like, and I even know just by going to Billboard that I'm not, like you said, there's so many charts to check. But I guess like, you almost have to pick and choose, I suppose, which ones you're going to sort of stay aware of. And
that's all
of,
you can do.
Yeah, because there's always, and that's why actually I'm so glad I'm not an artist at the moment because I don't even know how you get your stuff out there. Like with getting the notice, like with getting the notoriety, because there's just so many places for people to go to.
Yeah, and it's much more complicated. That's the thing, because it's not even just a question of people hearing you as much as it's also a question of, you know, like we're talking about brands trying to use music to further their products.
Right.
But a lot of times that winds up furthering the artists as well. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to even know what to do. It's not just a question of, well, I need to have a YouTube channel. It's way, way deeper than that at this point, you know, cause like they say, I mean, younger people definitely use music to feel like they belong to a group.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. It's like, people are really interested in letting people know what they like. I mean, like they love to share the music they're listening to, you know, like people born after the 80s use music and media entertainment apps 75% more than any other group, any other age group.
Wow.
Yeah, that's 75% crazy. More. And so they're constantly sharing stuff. So it's like you want to get in their face, whether it's, you know, being on like a, you know, being on like an ad for Red Bull or mm-hmm. being at the right festival. Those are the things you need to be doing. So it's easy to say, you know, people love to, again, dismiss like, oh, you know, they're on the internet. So everybody knows about them. But there's so much stuff on the internet. You could find 10 groups tonight that you would love that you've never heard of in a million years.
Right.
But I mean, it exists, but you got to be at the right place.
Exactly. Wow. Well, Patrick, thank you for this. We really appreciate your time as always.
Anytime.
That is Patrick Charles, our social media expert. Again, learn more about him on our website, kellyalexandershow.com. And of course, follow him on Twitter at GetPatrick.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
It is wedding season and time to raise a glass and toast the new couple. The only thing is, making a toast in front of the wedding guests, not to mention the happy couple, can be quite a daunting task and can lead to some shaky nerves. Never fear, we have enlisted the help of public speaking experts Katrin Kern and Chris Corbell to help you come up with the perfect wedding day toast. Katrin and Chris, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
So I know you two have been doing this for a while, but are you ever shocked to see or hear how freaked out people can be when they are asked to give a toast at either their friend's wedding or a family member's wedding? Because, you know, this really is like anxiety building.
I would be more shocked than someone who's actually calm.
Okay.
It's so funny. I was going to say the opposite. I'm actually shocked at how blasé some people are about it.
Right. Do you think that it's really on their character? Because, like, I actually DJed a wedding a couple of weeks ago, and one of the guys that had a speech, he, you could just see, was overly confident about himself. And so he just got up there like there was no problem. And then other people looked like they were about to pass out.
I think it's quite a range. I think that some people are actually in serious denial about what's about to go on. That's the only conclusion I can come to. Because if they really thought about what they're about to do, I think they would be more nervous. Some people look like they're about to pass out, I think, because maybe in a strange way, they're more clued into what's actually happening. But it's not necessary. And this is, you know, this is why we do what we do, because we want people to understand that there is a happy middle ground.
Okay. Now, what are the main factors, do you think, for people becoming super anxious? Do you think it's actually, like, I know we just talked about, you know, knowing what's exactly going on, but is it, do you think the actual pressure of standing in front of people or trying to sound intelligent?
I think it's different for every person. I think for some people, it is that pure, like, sort of animal instinct level of standing in front of a whole group of people. I think for some people, it is more cerebral, and they're concerned about what they're going to say and how they're going to come across. I just think that no matter what it is, it's important to breathe and get a hold of whatever it is that's running away with you.
Okay.
Being present in your body is the antidote to all of this.
What are some of the common myths about wedding toasts? Because I think, you know, there's a lot of people that would have assumptions.
Chris, what do you think?
Well, you know, a lot of people, going back to what we were just saying, think that as long as your toast is short, it's a good toast. And actually, I would say a short toast can be a terrible toast if you are not mentioning the key points. It's much more important to focus on what you need to say and taking the time to say it than going through it just being quick. You don't want to cheat them of this great moment in time.
Yeah, and then, like, one of them that is really funny, I don't know about how this is in Canada. Obviously, we are from the States, and we live in Los Angeles. So culturally, I don't know if this is the same, but I know that around the world, in some cultures, when you tap a piece of crystal, like a piece of stemware, at a reception with a utensil, and everybody starts joining in, that's a sign, here anyway, for the bride and the groom to kiss. And some people actually think that if you tap on your glass, it's going to get people's attention for you to make a toast. And it ends up being the most confusing, like, cacophony of things. And usually it'll just go by, the bride and groom will kiss, and you still didn't make your toast. So if it is the kind of reception where you can actually impromptu stand up and make a toast, and there isn't an actual, like, MC or somebody coordinating who speaks when, it's really important that you just stand in your place and raise your glass and just wait for people to realize that you're about to speak it will definitely take a second if it's a big reception, but it's worth it because people will know what's going on and they won't get confused about the whole kissing versus toasting thing.
And another thing is that people are always afraid of saying anything embarrassing. And I think you got to know the difference between humor and humiliation. The difference is one is enlightening and one is disparaging. If you're going to point out some feet of clay, it actually humanizes the couple. So as long as you don't say anything that would make your friend never speak to you again, it's just a general, gentle, good-natured big girlfriend.
And, you know, we spoke right now about the tapping on the glass and sort of there could be confusion if, you know, you're not certain. I know at the wedding that I just DJ'd, the couple was very adamant about having all the speeches go at once, pretty much. Like, it was sort of spread out during dinner, but it was in a controlled environment. Should the couple make sure that that happens for their speakers so that it is controlled so there's not that added anxiety?
Well, at the very least, the couple should make sure that there's somebody in control of when the floor is open and when it's not. I mean, there's every style of wedding. Some of them are really intimate and casual, so it makes perfect sense for somebody to give an impromptu toast. But there should at the very least maybe be somebody who is the arbiter of, like, who has the floor when. So you don't, I mean, even if it is going with the flow, you don't have two people standing up and trying to talk over each other or, you know, there should be someone who kind of is controlling the flow of how it goes. Kind of like on a talk show when the audience talks.
Right.
You know, in most traditional weddings, the best man operates as a master of ceremonies. So you can never really go wrong in that scenario because
right,
by doing that,
DJ or something, you know.
Or the DJ or the band leader, but if you give them the best man, that person can take time to know how to pronounce the other person's name. You know, you can actually have a proper sequence of who goes up and who goes up when.
Actually, speaking of that best man and you know, potential the maid of honor, do those two have added pressure for their speeches? Because I feel like you do.
Absolutely.
I hate to say it, but absolutely, yes, they do.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what should they be trying to accomplish, Chris, in their speeches?
Well, you know, no matter what, when you're the best man or you're the maid of honor, you're an ambassador. You're an ambassador to two different nations. You represent, if you're the best man, you represent the best man. But to the other side of that family that he's marrying into, they don't know him. And you're testifying to his good character as a future husband. To this fan, to your friend, to his side of the family, you're actually also vouching for why you think this woman will be a good member of the couple. Well, what do you think with the maid of honor, Catherine? How would you best describe it?
Absolutely,
that?
It is. It's all about giving the crowd a, 10-minute condensed version of why this is an amazing human being that their friend or their family member is marrying. And, you know, who is this person that's suddenly a part of these people's lives? And it is, it's also, Chris and I have discussed a lot because obviously all of this goes back to ancient rites and rituals that come from very, very old cultures and early part of humanity. And it's very important to realize that actually the speeches, especially the best man and maid of honor, and maybe even the parents, but mostly the honor attendants, are an extension of the ceremony, actually. They are the ones who are the members of the bride and groom circle who are paying tribute to the bride and groom and letting everybody else letting everyone else in. And then also there is the aspect, too, that goes the other way, where the maid of honor and best man are actually somewhat conveying the wishes and the feelings of the crowd. Not everybody can speak. This is a tradition that goes back to ancient Greece, actually, where there would be members of a culture or members of a society that would be chosen to go through a ceremony on behalf of every person in that culture, in that ceremony, in that society, so that, everybody is represented. And it's basically what goes on today.
I had a question with regards to the lineup of speeches and if you know that you have a super charismatic speaker. Because again, I'm just going to use this wedding as an example. Like, I didn't really, I know the bride that I was DJing the wedding for, not all that well, but you know, well enough that she wanted me to do this wedding. And so she actually had her aunt and uncle sort of be the MCs. Like, I sort of took care of some of the information, but you know, she obviously wanted a familiar touch. So that was fine. But just with regards to the run of speeches, what I found interesting is that this one girl that they had come up to speak, because one of the groom was actually a teacher. And so he had one of his former students who's now in her early 20s come up and speak. And she was terrible. She was absolutely terrible. Like, she started off, I thought, fairly strong in the first like minute. And then after that, I was like, oh my God, she's never going to shut up. She's rambling. She crowded like a whole year's worth of stuff into this, like probably, I would say, a good 12 minute speech. And like, all of us were dying. So as the couple, though, if you know, I'm sure you don't entirely know what someone's going to come up with, but do you stack your lineup? And what happens if you have the maid of honor and the best man that are doing their thing, but let's say you have a really fun uncle and you know he's going to kill it. Is that bad because he's going to make the maid of honor and the best man look stupid?
You know, years ago, before I did any of this, I was a stand-up comic. And one of the hardest things in the stand-up comedy world is to be the opener for someone who's better than you. And the second hardest thing is to be the one who comes on after someone who's better than you.
Right.
But the rule of thumb is this. If someone is stronger than you and they came on first, well, you've got an incredibly receptive audience because they're loose, they're happy, they're in a good mood. If you follow somebody who's just terrible, everyone is now, anything you do, comparatively speaking, is going to be wonderful. So it really doesn't matter in the long run. There is a structure in traditional wedding ceremonies to who goes first and who closes and who goes why. And if you want to stick with the traditions, then yeah, the best man does go first. And if you have that great uncle, you put that great uncle wherever you want. But in general, there is a series of who goes first, who finishes, and how things work out.
And traditionally now, the neo-tradition, now that maids of honor are speaking as frequently as best men, it's that the maid of honor actually goes last.
Okay.
And bookend with the two of them.
What happens with same-sex marriages? Does any of this change?
You know, it doesn't. It depends. It's funny. We don't distinguish for our purposes between same-gender marriages and opposite-gender marriages. We just distinguish between traditional and neo-traditional. And all we say to same-gender marriages, same-gender weddings, is you just decide who you feel like is going to feel most comfortable going first and who's going to feel most comfortable going last, and you kind of have a little bit more freedom there.
Okay.
And then the interesting thing in the neo-traditional weddings you can now see are the couple speech. It used to be there was a groom speech. That's a traditional way. The groom comes out, and they thank the family of the bride. They thank the people who attended.
They're actually the first people to speak, right, Chris?
Exactly. In fact, in a situation like that, they will actually come and introduce the best man. They're actually really the introduction of everything. But you now see, and this works really well with same-sex couples, the couple just come out, and they offer a couple speech. And then again, how does that work when you've got two maids of honor or two best men? It's pretty much the same deal.
Okay. Joining us on the show is public speaking experts Katrin Kern and Chris Corbel, helping us with all there is to do with regards to wedding toasts. Make sure to check out their website, makeatoast.com, and that's actually make-a-toast.com. How, or why, I should say, why is it important that you nail that first minute of the speech?
Katrin, you want to?
That's a good one for you.
Okay. Well, you know, the thing about the first minute of the speech is that it really sets up everything else. That first minute is, to use like a sports analogy, you know, you got to come out of the gate ready to go. And that is why it's one of the things. So one of the things you have to remember about when you do this and you come out at the first minute is you need to, we the audience, I hate using the word audience because it's performance, but the people in the room need to know who you are. What's your relationship to the groom, or what's your relationship to the bride? What's your relationship to the couple? Katrin always suggests opening with a throwaway line or a quote to get you grounded, what you say, to have your voice bounce across the room.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, yeah. Well, in terms of being heard, yeah, it's really important when you're speaking to be able to kind of gently hear a ping against the walls of the room or just in the space to kind of know that your voice is filling the space. But in terms of that, like, sort of throwaway line, at first when you're in a social situation, most of us are not paying attention. It's like, unless there really is a formal MC saying, and now there's going to be Miss Maid of Honor and she's coming on the stage and everyone is silent and waiting, which is very unusual at a party. Usually you might want to have something to say. Like, often I'll just say, oh, everybody looks so beautiful tonight, or something like that up there once I'm up there, because that gives people a chance to go, oh, it's starting now. And okay. You turn and you focus. And yes, that first minute, I know from a stand-up comedy perspective, Chris has said, that first minute is all about whether you're going to keep them or they're going to tune you out.
Yeah, okay. That's the thing. You're trying to make a connection. You're trying to make a connection. The best way to make a connection is say, hi, I'm Chris Corbell. I'm the groom's brother from another mother, and I know where all the bodies are buried.
Gotcha.
Whatever, I just made that. Right. But it gets everyone's attention. Oh, I know this guy is who he is. It's a character. It's whoever. But now I know, and now you've got their attention, and that's the only thing to get grounded and to hold attention that you need to accomplish in the first minute.
Guys, is it good to be a little bit left of center if you can pull it off, like to sort of stand out a little bit? Because, you know, again, I find speeches can be super boring, or not, but they can be. And I think some people actually dread at the wedding, oh, my God, who's coming up now? And, like, for example, I know at my brother's wedding, like, I mean, I'm a radio announcer, so everyone knows that I like to talk anyways, but I decided to be a little bit funny, and I had made this fake scroll. And so when I got up to speak, I just pretended that I threw out the scroll that looked like it was a mile and a half long, pretending I was going to read this whole thing. And then it made people laugh, and then I just was able to get into my little speech and then sort of get it out and done. Do you suggest props like I use?
If you can use them well, I mean, the answer to your question, is it good to be a little bit off of center, my response to that is, it's good to be yourself. I think the people who are getting into Dullsville and getting into like that horribly, horribly disconnected space that everybody gets so bored by, it's because they're trying to be something or accomplish something or do something that they have some concept about in their head, and they're not just being who they are. Obviously, you want to bring your best self. Ideally, this is a moment, if you only give one wedding toast in your entire life, ideally, it's a moment that you loved in your life, that you thought you gave everything you had and you connected, and it was a wonderful experience. So it's about bringing yourself, it's about bringing your best self, because you want everybody to enjoy it and be happy, and you want to be respectful. And obviously, like, there are fewer things that in life, maybe childbirth, that are, you know, bigger than getting married to your soulmate. And so you want to honor the occasion, but you need to bring yourself and be yourself too. And that's when I think you are irresistible.
And I think it's great that you brought the long scroll, but personally, I hate props. Because I think if you're bringing a prop, you're bringing a security blanket. And okay. If you're bringing a security blanket, there's a part of you that's checking out.
And you can use it for yourself as opposed to, as like what Chris was saying, a security blanket, mm-hmm. Then I have no problem with it. So there, he and I differ on that.
Okay.
You should listen to her, because now I'm just simply stating a personal preference. And anyone who wants to use a prop, it's great. Rubber chickens, cannonballs.
Yeah. Well, I know sometimes it can't work. Like, because, for example, again, at that wedding, the aunt who I told you was, you know, trying to sort of be the MC, she came out with this book, like, was trying, because again, I told you he was a teacher, and it was too inside. Like, the joke was, like, I didn't get it, you know, but it was obviously something to do about his career as a teacher in this big book that, you know, was, I think the gist was that he's very organized, and so they were trying to look like they were organized in their conducting the emceeing duties. But I could see where a prop wouldn't work. But I was just wondering if you could handle it, if it was something to do. Before I let you guys go, though, I did want to ask you this. Obviously, with a wedding, there's usually the rehearsal dinner. If you do have to do a speech, then do things differ with regards to the speech you're going to do at the rehearsal dinner as opposed to the actual reception?
Absolutely. In fact,
for the crazy props.
That's the crazy. Yeah. Go nuts. Yeah. You want to do like a 9-person toast? You want to, you know, have everyone dress up as Lady Gaga? What craziness can you think of, Catherine?
I don't know. The rubber chickens, you know, like any kind of crazy prop that you want to use. Inside jokes in general are hard because you really want everybody in the room to enjoy what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to do any sort of inside joke, the rehearsal dinner is usually a smaller, more intimate crowd, and so like that would be the time for that.
But I have to issue this warning, because while we're encouraging as much creativity at the rehearsal dinner, please keep in mind, someone's grandma might be there, someone's uncle might be there. You still try to keep it within a certain degree of clean.
Okay.
Yeah, and I just have one more myth to dispel before we go, and it's about memorization. This thing we keep talking about anxiety versus being blasé, there's a fine line in the middle, and it has to do sometimes with memorization. Memorization can take you out of yourself, and I would much rather see somebody be extremely familiar with their toast, their speech that they're going to make, and use notes, than be rigidly out of their body because they're trying to remember what they wrote.
Right. Actually, I can totally picture you as like picture that what you're describing, because like it's like not everyone's an actor who can do 15-page dialogue like remembering it. So I get it. Guys, thank you for your time. It's been so awesome to speak with you today.
Thank you. You too.
Cheers.
That's public speaking experts Katrin Kern and Chris Corbell helping us with all there is to do with wedding toasts. Again, make sure to check out their website for more information, makeatoast.com, and that's make-a-toast.com. We really appreciate you spending time with us on the show this week. And as always, a big thank you to my guests, Bill Wadhams, Katrin Kern, and Chris Corbell, and of course, the one and only Patrick Charles. Here is your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time from Charles Richards. Don't be fooled by the calendar. There are only as many days in the year as you make use of. Please check us out on all of our social media, of course, on Twitter, at Kay Alexander Show, our Facebook page, Kelly Alexander Show, and of course, our interviews up on our website, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.